Okay.
Sai l'ofizialeko de Deep Blue Sea filma ikusi berri dugu eta orain egingo dugu prentzaurrekoa. Buenos días.
Good morning. We've just seen the film in the official section of the Deep Blue Sea. So let's commence the press conference with the director, Terence Davies, the actor Tom Hiddleston, and the producers Kate Ogbourne and Sean O'Connor. So they are eagerly awaiting your first questions. First question here in the second row. Second row here, please. I hope you can all hear me now. Yes? Good. Thank you. The microphone he's using is not working yet, so we'll just wait until... Still can't hear him. Good. Congratulations for the film. Beautiful film, great film. Do you expect to win? What perspectives do you have vis-a-vis the festival? Do you expect to win the first prize, the Concha? Terence Davies, why... The film in this context, and how was the film, why place the film within that context, a period, I think he means, and also how was it to work with the rest of the cast?
Well, no, I mean, I made the film because I wanted to, because I've needed to. I'd never ever thought it would go, be invited anywhere, much less into a competition, because you don't make it for that reason. You have to make the film that you love. Which is what I did. I had a wonderful cast. I know everyone says that, but this is true. They were a joy, every one of them, and I'm enormously proud of them.
Hi, good morning. I'd like to know, given that British films or British cinema is quite concerned about feminism issues, and the film produced by Glenn Close, Feminism Seems to Triumph, at the end of the day, and give a solution to that sort of feminism. This is a love story, but the woman is the victim at the end of the day here. What role do we place ourselves? What place do we... He's married because of convenience, and then she falls in love with someone who is destructive for her. So where do we place her at the end of the day?
Well, I think you're wrong to think it's about feminism. It's not. It's about love and the nature of love. And the crux of the film is each individual, her husband, herself, and Freddie, love each other, but they love each other in a different way and can't give what the others want. So that's not feminism at all. That's just about the nature of love and being human. I don't see her as a victim at all. At the end, she decides to live by not killing herself. That in itself is courageous. And the reason it's courageous is because when you know that what life is going to be for her, and she decides to carry on, that's really, it's stoic in the greatest sense of the word. I don't think she's a victim at all. I think, in fact, she's a heroine. But I don't think it's got anything to do with feminism.
And I should also add that I think if Rachel were here, she would take you to task on that too. She and I very much believe that this is a film about the triumph of feeling over propriety. That your heart will lead you into places which seem dangerous, but the heart rules the head, and it's about a woman fighting for her life, trying to break free from the shackles of what she's inherited from her father and her husband, and she's fallen head over heels in love, and that's a good thing.
Yeah, I just wanted to ask, the play itself, obviously you've adapted it from a play, but the silences are just as important as the words, and in fact it feels quite stripped down, especially initially, and I wondered if you could talk a little bit about the importance of, you know, seeing things rather than talking them out, and also adapting the play itself.
Well, the great thing about cinema is that it actually photographs what goes on behind the eyes. Very often, you just leave the camera running a little longer, and someone will do something wonderful. But cinema touches us viscerally, and it's more than dialogue. Two things about the silences. I grew up in the 50s, so I knew what it felt like, and there was very little extraneous sound. You know, you had a radio in the house, that was it. You may have heard the cars from the main road, but most of the time it was actually quiet, so you actually did hear people walking around the house and walking up and downstairs, and the creak of the house as it was silent. But in drama, you can play those silences like music, and the actors felt that, and that's something that's not acted, it's felt. And very often you can play the silence, you can take it much longer than it normally would be, or cut it very short, and it'll have completely two different things. The play is very wordy, and I'd never done a play before, but the first act is entirely exposition. And if you can show someone something, there's no point in them telling us, because we can see it. And that's where cinema is so powerful. It's the poetry of the ordinary. These people are ordinary people after the war in Britain. I mean, Britain was absolutely bankrupt and threadbare in that time. And what happened was that they thought that after the war was won, England would go back to exactly the way it was. Well, of course it didn't. You know, and all those barriers began to break down. And the real greatness of her character is the fact that here is someone who is very conventional, but does an unconventional thing. It's like Nora at the end of Doll's House, who decides to walk out. And when it was first performed in Germany, on alternate nights, they had a happy ending, which is very, very wonderful when you think about that. But silences can tell so much by not saying anything. There's a moment at the end when Tom is tying his shoes, and all he does is goes like that. Now, that's felt. You can't direct that. When he gets his hat off the wall, it takes three takes. I mean, that's agonizing. I mean, I grew up in a very large working class family where there were rows, I mean, huge rows, and then it would all go silent in that particular British way, and no one would say anything. And you'd long for someone to say something, just anything, to get this awful silence away. And when it's played properly, it's very, very exciting. It can be overdone, but sorry, that was a very, very long answer to your rather short question.
Can I add one thing to that? Which I think that the theatre is about words, and silences in the theatre can often ruin a play if the play is about argument and about the exchange of ideas. The theatre thrives on that exchange, but the cinema is about behaviour. And when you don't need to hear the words, as a viewer and an audience, you can read thoughts. There's no way you can read thoughts in a theatre. You need the language to access the material, but the camera can read things behind your eyes that you don't need to say.
Hola, ¿qué tal? Buenos días.
Hi, good morning. Also, along the lines of the silences, it's a question for Tom. I would like to know how you worked with Terence Davies and Rachel Weisz and yourself, you and Rachel, let's say, those silences during the rehearsals and during the shooting of the film, the silences, the way you looked at each other, those looks, and the tempo that was set forth by the director. Thank you.
It's a great question. Really, the first thing that I do when I sign on to a project is put my trust in the hands of the director. And in this case, Terence was also the screenwriter, and he'd written one of the most beautiful and powerful screenplays I'd ever seen and read. And all I had to do was play it out. It's a strange thing about acting is that the camera's not really interested in anything that we prepare. It's interested in the spontaneity of life. And I was very lucky to have a scene partner in Rachel Weisz, who's the most wonderful actress. She is has an incredible courage and expressiveness and range. She's utterly fearless about playing the extremity of her emotional range. She can cry and laugh and then be very, very still. And I really enjoy working with her, and sometimes we wouldn't rehearse things, would we? Occasionally we would run the lines, but we would sort of loosely find our positions within a scene and then have a go. And Terence and Florian Hofmeister, our esteemed cinematographer, would capture the beauty of those accidents. It's amazing. That's really what cinema is capturing the beauty of accidents.
Hola, ¿qué tal? Buenos días. Me gusta.
Hi, good morning. I would like to ask Terence Davies, your cinema is a bit ritualistic, and in this film you see things like the camera comes in through the windows and how you use traditional music sung in the bar to transmit those feelings. How much nostalgia is there in this vintage type film, and how much is it a claim in favor of people continue to live their love up until the final consequences? Thank you.
Well, I hope no nostalgia at all, because nostalgia always trivializes everything, because it's what it says is that life was really wonderful those days, and weren't we all very, very happy, and we just won the war, and weren't we all jolly together? Well, we weren't. It wasn't like that. I remember not only, as I said before, not only how it looked like, but how it felt like, and that's even more important. Nostalgia, I hope, is not there. These lives are lives that are led. They're small lives. No great thing happens. No great cataclysm happens, except within the characters themselves. The act of love and falling in love is the great cataclysm in their lives, because from that one thing, everything follows. I suspect I've been heavily influenced by Chekhov, because Chekhov does the same thing. He does it much greater than I do, but it's about the nature of small things happening and people saying things at the oddest times. You know, there's a wonderful moment in Three Sisters when Tributykin, after the fire, he says, you know, I go to my club and I pretend that I know about Shakespeare and I've never read it, and then I suddenly realize that the man died on my operating table yesterday and I feel a fool, and then says, tarara bum die, I'm sitting on a tomb die, which is almost Ionesco, of juxtaposing one thing with another immediately. But I hope there's no nostalgia, because I think it's truer than that. It may be to other people. I don't know about it being ritualistic, but I suspect that's my Catholic upbringing. That's where that comes from.
I don't think it's nostalgic either. I hope that it's a story that touches people of every age and every time, simply because it's about love. It's about falling in love. It's about the complexity of love and the darker side of passion. And love is blind. Love is foolish. Love is headstrong and headlong, and can take us to places we never dreamt of. And I hope that is the thing that people take away.
Hola, buenos días.
Hi, good morning. I'm over here at the back. Over here. I would like to ask the director a question. This film is quite risky. You're proposing, emotionally speaking, to the audience, that is, to enter or not enter. I'd like to know, what was your fear, despite all of your experience? What fear did you have when you started this project? And also, I'd like you to talk about adult love, because as of late in cinema, we're seeing a lot of films of people falling out of love, people of the same age as Rachel, people like Rachel Weisz, but they're very young. This is a love story, an adult love story. So there's two questions, your fears, and could you talk about this adult love which takes place in the film? Thank you.
Well, fears are the usual ones, of not getting it shot in time, of going over budget. Those are purely practical, because we shot it in 25 days, and we had bitterly cold weather, I can tell you. That was a real worry. It's not a worry, it's a concern rather than a worry, of getting to the essence of the story. Because if you just simply photograph the play, then it's a record of a spoken event, and that's not interesting. You've got to get to its core, to its subtext, and the subtext is the nature of love, as Thomas said. I'm always concerned about getting it right. I'm very concerned that the actors are not made to look foolish, because they very often can be, and I think that's iniquitous when an actor or an actress is made foolish by bad direction. I think that's appalling and unforgivable. The scenes, when they're in bed, I actually wrote in the script, these scenes are not explicit, because I don't think explicit lovemaking tells you anything. A, usually they've always got good bodies, usually they've got body makeup on, and nobody ever gets cramp or farts. You know, that's not, you know, it's not real lovemaking. And I wanted to get over the nature of that first passion of love, the power of it, and also its beauty. Because it can be beautiful. It doesn't have to be animalistic. It doesn't have to be ritualistic. I tried, because I've come from a large family and I've seen all my sisters and brothers get married. Like most children who are the youngest of 10, you look and you watch and you learn things that you remember much, much later. I think it's got to be intelligent and not silly. That's why I hope it is adult. And I tried to respect the subtextual meaning of the play, and also to actually make sure, as I say, that the actors are not doing anything unseemly, that they look at the picture and say, you know, I think that scene should go, or I really feel embarrassed there. I would hate any actor to say that to me, because I would feel that was a complete failure and a betrayal of their roles as artists.
First of all, congratulate you. I love the film a lot, and I would like you to talk about certain some of the plastic elements, because what's quite present is painting is quite present. It reminded me of Hopper's work, the painter who transmitted that anguish, existential anguish, and I would like you to talk a bit more about that plastic proposal, the relationship with painting. Could you just step back for the microphone, if you'd be less so kind? I you're getting a bit of distortion. Thank you. Lovely.
Is that all right?
That's lovely. Thank you.
My greatest love is Vermeer. I fell in love with Vermeer when I was very young. I know very little about painting, but I love Vermeer. And Peter de Hoogh as well. But what's wonderful about them is this unutterable stillness. But the movement within the frame, and you could look at those paintings forever and never get bored. And of course they're sheer beauty, because he actually painted through a camera obscura. I'd known the Barber Violin Concerto for quite a long time, and it's interesting as an American masterpiece, because you hear Aaron Copland, which is very wide and American and open, whereas with Barber, it's echoes of the late Romantic tradition, and the recording we chose has little elements of high fits with that big rubato, which gives it this immense romance, as well as its immense aching longing. But when I was designing the opening, I thought it has to do it in such a way that we say, this is where we are, how do we introduce the characters? I grew up on what were called the women's pictures in the 1950s, like All That Heaven Allows, Magnificent Obsession, Love is a Many Splendid Thing. The opening 2 minutes of All That Heaven Allows is a real influence. And it's not a great film, but it's beautifully crafted. And in the first 2 minutes, you know where you are, you know where it's at, you know who the three main characters are in 2 minutes, and you've got List on the piano, on the soundtrack as well. I sit, when I'm writing, I see the shots, and then sometimes the music comes later. I'd always known that I'd want to use the slow movement of the barber from the word go. I have to see what the shots are, so that when I write it as I see it, so that when we go on the set, I know every single shot. And if a shot doesn't work, then I can say, oh, well, if we did that, that would be better. Or on occasions, you know, Florian would say, have you thought of this position? And I thought, no, well, let's go there, and that's wonderful. Should we track in there and say, yes, but only when she does so-and-so. But the circular shots were written originally as tracks, three tracks. I mean, and I looked at it and thought, God, this is really clumsy. I mean, these tracks will go on forever. People will be bored to tears. And I don't know where it came from. I have no idea. I just thought, no. If the camera turns and it constantly turns left to right and is linked by dissolves, then it gives not just a circularity, it gives a lovely shape to it. But I have no idea where that came from, none at all, thank God. Whoever's up there, you know, gave me a bit of inspiration that day. But it has to be felt, and it has to be seen with the inner eye, it has to be heard with the inner ear, and felt with the inner voice. If that doesn't happen, then I can't find a frame. And that only happened twice on this. I couldn't find a frame, and I really got worried. And I had a wonderful bit of advice from the script supervisor. She said, is the action true? And I thought, you're right. It's not true. That's why I can't find the frame. And then we solved it. But great piece of advice. Great piece of advice.
Hi, I'd like to know whether in this exploration of the nature of love, there's also a bit of the insatisfaction of love, which is one of the pains that human beings go through nowadays, especially from a psychological standpoint.
Everyone goes through pain in any kind of love. Did I hear a dog bark? It was terribly exciting. there's that famous song that's in The Eras. Plaisir d'amour, chagrin d'amour. And that's what love is. You know, if you love someone deeply and you lose them, that's very hard. If you lose them through death, you know, the great love of my life was my mother. I miss her every day. I tell her I love her every day. That's very, very hard. The hardest part is when you hear a phrase or someone's laugh that's like someone you know. And it's so painful. But the great thing about love is that we do wonderful things for it. Do horrible things, yes, but ultimately it's such a powerful emotion that only we humans feel. And if we can capture that and the truth of that, whether it's pleasurable or full of pain, it has to be looked at and it has to be felt properly. And if you look at something truthfully, both its pain and its pleasure, I don't know, it makes it, for me anyway, somehow more bearable.
I think real love is has so much complexity inside it. The love that Terence is exploring isn't just a romantic one. It's not light and fluffy and covered in rainbows. It's somebody once said to me, the opposite of love is indifference, not hate. And if you think about it, love and hate sit very close together, side by side, on either side of a very fine line. And the love that's being explored in the deep blue sea is all-consuming, for whomever you choose, for Hester, for Freddie Page, for William Collier, and none of them are indifferent, and they're all in love, and they're all in pain, because if you love someone, you risk losing them. And that's what this is about, I think.
Buenos días de nuevo.
Good morning again. A reflection and a question. There was a myth that we have in Spain. We've got the best dubbers that dub film cinema. I think after listening the voice of Tom in the film and here in the press conference, I think something important urges or comes to mind. You have a splendid voice for cinema as well as for theater. Let's hope we see it in original version so that we can truly listen to his voice. And therefore, and the question is the following. What drew my attention within the way you presented the film is that there's a lot of night or interiors which are well illuminated or well lit. I'm not criticizing. There's a lot of darkness. There's a lot of darkness within the film. This darkness, is it another character of the film? Or the darknesses?
Oh, Lord, I don't know.
We shot it in...
Things are felt, and if they're felt, you don't... it's not conscious. It's below consciousness. It's instinct. And if you feel, when Collier comes to see her, that scene gradually gets dark. I feel that that's right, rather than know why it's right. I'd never acted professionally, but I know when I was at a drama school, you do things that you can't explain. We did the Cherry Orchard, and there are things that you do that you just can't explain, but they feel right. It's like trying to talk about style. One can't, because I can't see it the way you can. I have no aesthetic distance on it. I've seen it 300 times in the cutting, and you think I can't sit through it again. I know every cut, you know, but it's instinct, and I can't explain instinct.
Can I just say that it is quite deliberate, though, that Terence opens the film in the dark and it finishes in the daytime, so the action of the film is from darkness into the light, so it's actually more optimistic, we'd hope, than the play is. So there's a metaphorical use of darkness and light, I think.
And thank you for being so kind about my voice.
Any more questions, please? No más preguntas.
No further questions. Thank you very much, ladies and gentlemen. Thank you.
Thank you. I'm sorry. Okay. Yes, we should.